The spill itself was significantly larger than anybody had thought up front.
Kalis Energy reports a spill on the North Slope. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Morris Communications sells three newspapers in Alaska.
It's harder and harder for either individual papers or smaller chains to stay competitive.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The state reports that more than 7,000 gallons of oil leaked from a North Slope well owned by Kalis Energy. Tom DeRuyter is with the Department of Environmental Conservation. He says DEC thinks most of the spill was contained to a gravel pad, but about 3 gallons of oil made it out to the tundra.
I don't want to minimize the size of this spill. That was a lot of oil that came out of this well, and it was something that happened without notice, and it took a long time to really understand what had happened and for everybody to react accordingly, and that is very unusual.
Kalis first reported the spill in mid-June. Then the company thought just 5 gallons had escaped a cellar surrounding the well.
The spill itself was significantly larger than anybody had thought up front, and that led to the migration outside of the gravel pad.
The spill came from a well that was drilled and plugged in 2013. The oil that leaked is not crude. Rather, it's a mixture of fluids Kalis put in the well, described by the state as mineral oil and diesel freeze protection fluid. The state thinks the incident happened after water filled the cellar and froze. Ice damaged a valve and allowed the oil to escape. The state also reports that plugs in the bottom of the cellar were not in place, allowing the water to flow in. But DeRuyter says until the investigation is complete, he can't say if human error was a factor. Cleanup on the spill is ongoing. Kalis did not agree to an interview for this story. In a statement, the company said it is working with DEC to minimize damage. Alaska's media landscape is about to undergo a change. 2 daily newspapers and a weekly are among 11 papers getting sold by Morris Communications to Gatehouse Media for a reported $120 million. The deal includes the Juneau Empire, Peninsula Clarion in Kenai, and weekly Homer News. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
Newsrooms learned about the sale of their papers to Gatehouse Media early Wednesday morning. The upstate New York-based chain is one of the fastest-growing media companies in the country.
So I got an email from corporate, from Morris, and announcing it, and they referred us to, referred me to a press release on the Morris website.
That's Michael Armstrong, editor of the Homer News. He's been at the paper since 1999.
The Gatehouse people are visiting the Morris properties today and tomorrow, and they'll come down to Kenai and to Homer, and we'll find out more from them.
The Juneau Empire has been owned by the Georgia-based Morris family since 1969. They also bought the Peninsula Clarion in 1990. Dee Dee McKenzie is publisher of all 3 papers, and she says she's staying in that role.
The sale will actually be final October 2nd, and after that, you know, we'll know a lot more. So for now, it's really business as usual.
The Kenai-based executive says the Morris family had been looking at selling the papers for about a year.
Gatehouse was a really good fit, and it's a great opportunity for these newspapers to also become a part of Gatehouse Media, which is a larger newspaper company. They're in 36 states, and so it's a great opportunity for us.
The offloading of 11 newspapers by the family-owned Morris chain is part of an industry-wide trend, says analyst Rick Edmonds of the Poynter Institute.
Well, I think we're in a period of quite a lot of consolidation, and even the language of the press release sort of follows a storyline that's been developing, which is it's harder and harder for either individual papers or smaller chains to stay competitive.
Gatehouse now owns more than 130 papers in mostly small and mid-sized markets, more than any other chain. Edmund says Gatehouse finds ways to consolidate its holdings for efficiency.
They have a very large copy editing production layout center in Austin, Texas that does all of their papers.
The company emerged from a $1.2 billion bankruptcy in 2013 and has since been recapitalized by a private equity firm. Since then, it's expanded rapidly into the nation's second largest newspaper chain after Gannett. Its parent company is a publicly traded company called New Media Investment, which is backed by a private equity fund. And here's where it gets complex. The Fortress Investment Group controls less than 1% of company stock, but wields an enormous amount of control.
The bigger the company gets, the more money that the external manager Fortress collects.
That's Jeff Gordon, a sports columnist with the Post-Dispatch in St. Louis. He's also president of the United Media Guild, which represents unionized workers at 18 Gatehouse papers. He's critical of how a financial entity is rearranging small media companies.
How it works, basically, Fortress Investment Group operates as the external manager, so it gets millions of dollars in revenue from, quote-unquote, managing this company and basically arranging for financing, backing purchases.
Fortress Investment Group is reaping a windfall in fees, and he's worried that it's at the expense of the newspapers in the long term. The Morris family will retain some holdings in Alaska. It's not selling the Juneau Empire's building or the Alaska Journal of Commerce, Alaska Equipment Trader, and the weekly Chugiak Eagle River Star. With reporting from Aaron Bolton and Homer, I'm Jacob Resnick in Juneau.
The realities of the Southeast King Salmon closure will hit home tomorrow, Thursday, when no one, whether fishing commercially or recreationally, will be permitted to retain one of Alaska's most sought-after species. Industry groups from both the commercial and sports sectors have been sorting through the limited information available from the state about the closure and soothing the tempers of their members. One thing is certain, though, both sectors want to ensure that 2017's unprecedented closure is not repeated in the future. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The King closure leaves about 31,000 fish in the water, which might otherwise have been harvested by commercial trawlers. In a state that tallies up seafood harvests in the millions of tons, what are 31,000 fish?
They're literally worth their weight in gold.
Dale Kelly has been the director of the Alaska Trawlers Association for three decades.
You know, the financial cost of no king salmon for the troll fleet, we just don't easily recover from that, but we definitely get we're grateful that we've got a big coho run and that Fish and Game's going to let us take them, that's for sure.
The coho this year are plentiful, maybe even a record return. But silvers are small, and the price difference with kings is substantial. Back in the first 4 days of July, Southeast trawlers landed 63,000 kings and were paid between $8 and $10 a pound. Everyone knew that this was going to be a skinny summer season, and prices remained high, especially after spring trolling was abruptly shut down when kings were not showing up in large numbers in Southeast Alaska's 11 major river systems. But a total closure in summer?
Given the lack of historical precedent for such an overarching closure, I can't say anyone expected something like this to happen.
Samantha Weinstein is the director of the Southeast Alaska Guides Organization. Weinstein is concerned that the closure will have a chilling effect on bookings.
Essentially, this is a client-centered business, and you want to make your clients experience the best possible. And not being able to keep some fish can obviously get in the way of that.
Neither Weinstein or Kelly has a full grasp of the numbers driving the decision to completely shut down king fishing in the region. According to Charlie Swanton, the deputy commissioner of Fish and Game, who's taking most of the heat for the call, there is no single smoking gun. Rather, it's a combination of historic low returns in Alaska's rivers and...
secondarily, there are some stocks that in northern British Columbia per se, the Fraser inclusive, that have experienced similar poor conditions, and they are in pretty dire straits as well.
And there's a third problem, one that's probably the biggest question mark hanging over Alaska's fisheries, ocean survival. The number of juvenile kings leaving Alaska's rivers in the spring is pretty good. Hatchery releases of all species have been large. The fish just aren't coming back. Dale Kelly with the Alaska Trollers Association says it's clear that this isn't a fishing problem. She wonders if Alaska's unilateral decision to close fishing will make any difference if Canada and Washington State don't follow suit.
So we're managing to send a fraction of fish down to the Fraser River that might not even get it down there to the river mouth for natural circumstances, much less if they got a fishery gauntlet in the way.
Kelly has faith in the scientists and managers of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to make decisions in the best interest of the fish. She just wants everyone to share the pain equally. Otherwise, she says, it's a de facto reallocation dressed up as conservation. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
In an effort to curb skyrocketing health care costs, Anchorage is testing a new clinic specifically for city employees. Last night, the Anchorage Assembly approved a three-year contract with a company called Vera Whole Health to start in 2018. The move means access to primary and preventative care at a clinic specifically for employees and family members enrolled in the municipality's health plan. It's a program similar to one already in place for Anchorage School District employees. Supporters in the mayor's administration and on the assembly say easy access to routine and preventative care will reduce costly ER visits and medical interventions later on. The cost of the contract is just under $11 million. It's about the same amount projected to be saved over the 3 years of the contract, according to the administration, though more substantial savings wouldn't begin to appear in the city's budget for several years. Two conservative assembly members representing Eagle River were the only votes against the measure, saying it expands government and alternatives in the private sector haven't been sufficiently researched. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the curious economy of fresh fish in the country's busiest commercial fishing port.
They're being caught in Alaska, then being sent all the way over to Asia, and then coming right back here to a place like on Alaska where you can buy it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
A federal agency is asking for input on an in-state natural gas pipeline. The Alaska Standalone Pipeline would bring gas from the North Slope to Wasilla. It's designed to deliver gas to communities like Fairbanks and throughout South Central Alaska. The Army Corps of Engineers is the lead agency working on an environmental impact statement for the gas line project. The current version of the statement, released in June, is updated from a 2012 version. It covers things like environmental consequences of the project footprint, transporting the gas, new access roads, and the 13 construction camps needed to build it. Sandy Gibson is the gas pipeline project manager for the Army Corps. She says the Corps is focused on the parts of the project that could affect people.
In cases of socioeconomics, you have job growth opportunities, you have employment. On the flip side, you have more stress for government support facilities or at local clinics, at hospitals, etc.
The project is managed by the State Gas Line Corporation, which is also tasked with developing a smaller but larger gas pipeline, a similar but larger gas pipeline that would bring gas from the North Slope into Cook Inlet and then sell it overseas. Gibson says people sometimes confuse the two projects.
It seems that in the last couple of decades, there's been some type of a pipeline project that's evolved into another revised project. So I think that a lot of people here in Alaska have a history with pipeline projects in general.
This summer, a team from the Corps has traveled around the state holding meetings and updating people on the environmental review process. So far, Gibson says they've heard a lot of concern about its potential effects on subsistence.
One of the comments made was that there was concern about caribou migration and that it wasn't necessarily due to the pipeline being elevated, but it had more so to do with helicopters flying the length of the pipeline.
This could be problematic during peak season when hunters have a short window to bag a caribou and the noise could spook the herd. The comment deadline is August 14th. Gibson says the goal is to publish a final impact statement by the end of 2018, but there's still a long road ahead for Alaska's in-state gas pipeline. After it gets an impact statement, the project still needs to get permit decisions from federal agencies like the Corps to be built. Gibson says the environmental review and permitting process ideally go hand in hand, but finishing the review doesn't necessarily mean an agency will grant a permit. A Princess Cruise Lines ship traveling through southeast Alaska's Inside Passage hit a humpback whale that became lodged on the bow. The whale was removed after the Grand Princess docked in downtown Ketchikan Wednesday morning, and the dead animal was towed to a nearby beach. In a statement released Wednesday, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Office of Law Enforcement says its officers are investigating the cause of the whale's death. Gary Freitag of the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program says he will be involved in the necropsy to determine how it died. He says it's possible that the whale was already dead before it was struck by the ship.
So you really don't know whether the ship had anything to do with it or not. The necropsy will have a tendency to determine the best we can whether it was, you know, hit while it was still alive or whether it was dead floating or you know, you can also look at the decomposition and see how long it was before the animal was hit, whether it was right away or whether it was floating around for a week.
Freitag says he hadn't yet seen the dead whale himself, but he was told it was about 30 feet long, which he says means it was a calf.
Because humpbacks are usually in the 40s to 50 foot when they're adults. So it's a young humpback from what I understand.
Freitag says he's working with NOAA officials to schedule the necropsy, which likely will take place Thursday. He says there are a lot of logistics to work out first, including rounding up volunteers to help. Unalaska is America's most productive fishing port, hauling in more than 780 million pounds of seafood in 2015. That fish gets shipped all over the world, and eventually, after processing, some of it comes back to Unalaska. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk looks into where it goes and why you can't buy fresh fish in town.
At one of Unalaska's grocery stores, the frozen fish section is almost entirely fish from Asia.
Let's take a peek. All right, rabbit fish, whole fish coming from Vietnam, baby tuna just wrapped in plastic. This is from Vietnam.
Down the street at the Safeway, you can buy fish from Alaska, but it has some stamps in its passport.
Wild Alaskan cod fillets. Just generic Safeway brand. And they're caught in Alaska, but they're a product of China. So they're being caught in Alaska, then being sent all the way over to Asia, and then coming right back here to a place like Unalaska where you can buy it, where it's frozen and packaged up.
Even though Unalaska brings in more fish than anywhere in America, it's all exported, so you can't buy it fresh. Jorn Skabel is visiting from Bremerhaven, Germany. He's the head of the seafood purchasing department at Frosta, a European frozen food manufacturer.
We always trying to buy from, certified fisheries, which are really sustainable. We have no interest that the tree will be cut where we are all sitting on.
Frosta buys pollock fillet blocks to make fish fingers and breaded fillets. For this season, Frosta is snapping up 3.3 million pounds, roughly half of what they'll buy over the course of the year.
It's really big business, and of course we need more.
According to Michael Coleman, general manager of Coastal Alaska Premier Seafoods, the pollock gets sent all over the world.
The fillet block goes to Germany. And a little bit goes to the McDonald's users. The other roughly half of the product goes to Japan for surimi and Korea for surimi products.
In all, it takes about 80 days from the fish being caught in the Bering Sea, processed, packed up in Unalaska, and shipped to Germany. Then the fillet blocks get turned into fish products that can be bought across Europe. So I asked my brother Eli, who lives in Amsterdam, to look for it the next time he was at the store.
It does look as if there are, fish sticks that are from Alaska.
The fish sticks Eli found were made with fish from the Bering Sea.
All right, here goes nothing.
it doesn't necessarily bring up memories of being in the U.S., but maybe it's kind of American because of a breaded part.
Eli prefers fresh fish, but the frozen Alaska fish he gets is still fresher than the fish I can buy in the grocery store. To get fresh fish here, you have to catch it yourself. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The state will limit caribou hunting in the eastern interior along the Taylor and Top of the World highways. An Alaska Department of Fish and Game announcement says the no-hunt corridor prohibits harvest of caribou within 100 feet along both sides of the road during a state hunt for 40-mile caribou, which opens August 29th. Fish and Game spokeswoman Doreen Parker McNeil says the corridor addresses safety and conservation issues.
Members of the public, as well as some law enforcement officials, have voiced a lot of concerns about hunters shooting from and across the highway, particularly on or near curves in the road and in areas with houses and campgrounds. And we've had a lot of reports documenting hunters shooting into groups of caribou from the edge of the highway, and it results in wounding loss.
Parker McNeil says the restriction is also aimed at limiting the harvest when a large portion of the herd crosses the highway. The no caribou harvest corridor runs the entire length of the Top of the World Highway and a stretch of the Taylor Highway as well. In November of 2015, a private plane crashed near Eldred Rock in the Lynn Canal. The crash injured four Haines residents who swam to shore to save themselves. An investigation is now complete, but as KHNS's Abby Collins reports, it's still unclear why the plane went down.
It's been more than a year and a half since pilot Mike Makoviak's plane crashed into the cold waters of the Lynn Canal, injuring him and three passengers. Still, the National Transportation Safety Board doesn't know exactly what happened. A final report from the group determined the probable cause to be a loss of engine power due to fuel exhaustion. It also cites the pilot's decision to continue the flight after seeing his fuel gauges were close to zero. In November 2015, Haines resident Makoviak, his wife Martha, their son Nick, and friend Victoria Hansen left Juneau in a Cessna 180 bound for Haines. But the plane did not reach its destination. According to the NTSB investigation, the aircraft descended into the Lynn Canal about 23 miles southeast of Haines. Makoviak told the NTSB he noticed both of the plane's fuel gauges were reading zero partway into the flight. He told the safety board he'd left Juneau with sufficient fuel to complete the trip. Makoviak believed an electrical malfunction was causing the gauges to show an inaccurate reading. He says the engine continued to run normally, so he chose to continue to Haines. He also told the NTSB he never smelled fuel inside the plane. Soon after, the plane's engine lost all power and Makoviak was unable to restart it. He told the NTSB he couldn't find a safe place to land on the beach, so he decided to ditch the plane in the water. Everyone on board was able to get out and swim to shore, where they were later rescued. They all survived but suffered hypothermia. Martha Makoviak suffered the most severe injury and spent a couple weeks in a Seattle hospital. She spoke with KHNS about the crash after her recovery at the end of 2015.
I was swimming mostly on my back, and I kept turning around to see how much further I had to go. And there was a bigger swell than I expected, and that kept washing over me. And that whole time, I was just praying the whole time, "Lord, I'm not ready to die, not yet, please."
The NTSB could not determine why the fuel exhaustion and subsequent loss of engine power occurred. The final report says it's likely the fuel system was compromised, but that could not be confirmed. The plane sunk into the water and has not been recovered. The safety board says if it is ever found, there will be further investigation. In Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
50 years ago this week, the Fairbanks area experienced unprecedented rainfall. The precipitation channeled from surrounding hills into the Chena River, resulting in an epic flood that devastated the interior city. 5 decades later, signs are going up around Fairbanks to remind people of what happened. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Standing by the Chena River in downtown Fairbanks, National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum explains how an already wet streak back in August 1967 culminated with intense precipitation as the remnant of a typhoon pushed across interior Alaska.
Some places had 6 to 9 inches of rain over that period of time.
All that rain flowed down the Chena, Salcha, and Tanana rivers, resulting in the Great Flood of August 67. The high water displaced thousands of people and did tens of millions of dollars in damage. A history Plum is leading a project to share with the public.
There's been more than a generation that has passed since the flood, and so a lot of people, we've run into some people who didn't even know there was a flood in 67, so that sort of piece of history is already being lost.
The project includes placement of informational and high watermark signs around town. I catch up with Plum as he and U.S. Geological Survey hydrologist Matt Shelikins take measurements for installation of a high watermark sign near an historic downtown cabin along the Chena.
Some locations, like here near the river, we're looking at about 5 feet of water above ground level. Most places throughout downtown Fairbanks were 1.5 to 3 feet of water.
Shelikins and Plum underscore that it wasn't just the depth of the floodwater, but the huge area it encompassed.
The Tanana was flowing approximately 250,000 cubic feet per second when 100,000 is considered flooding.
And it's hard to estimate because yeah. The Chena and the Tanana were one here in Fairbanks, you know, one continuous area underwater.
Shelikins unfolds a flood map in the back of his pickup truck.
So we've got, from Birch Hill here, UAF over here, and this is Chena Ridge behind the pump house. The airport was just barely above flood elevation there. You can see the blue numbers are the approximate water depth over by the library, 2.5, 3 feet deep.
Areas of higher ground served as gathering spots for flood evacuees. Plum points to the bluff near the entrance to the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
That was sort of a boat landing spot for people evacuating town and getting up onto the higher ground at the university. So there'll be a sign there showing how high the water was.
Plum notes that water will never reach such heights again due to protection provided by the Chena Flood Control Dam and levee built after the Great Flood. The project in North Pole is the location of one of 3 interpretive panels marking the 50th anniversary of the 67 flood. Governor Bill Walker is among officials and local residents scheduled to speak at a flood anniversary event in downtown Fairbanks August 15th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harball and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Jacob Resnick and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Abby Collins in Haines, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.